got my glasses. I can't see.
That's September. Have a good weekend.
No.
Have a good weekend. I agree.
the next one. Oh, he's coming home. Thank you.
Hello. Hi.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm good. It's Tutor Jess on the call. I was just going to get our group started. I wanted to first start off by taking a little roll call. So I have a list of names that are on the call today, so I'm going to call your name, and I want you to let me know whether you want to be called on to answer questions during the group. Is everybody ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the first name I have on my list is Blessin. Is there a Blessin here? Blessyn. Okay. Next name I have on my list is Gretchen. Is there a Gretchen on the call? Okay. Next name I have on my list is Donna.
I am on the call.
Donna, great. Donna, would you like to be called on to answer questions during the session? Yes or no?
No.
No. Okay. All right. Next name on my list is Vicky. Is there a Vicky?
I'm on the call.
Okay, Vicky, would you like to be called on to answer questions?
No.
No. Okay, next on my list is Kristen.
I'm here.
Is there a Kristen here? Hi, Kristen. Would you like to be called on to answer questions?
Sure.
Sure, great, thank you. All right, next on my list is Judith. Is there a Judith? Okay. Next on the list is Teresa.
I'm here, but no for being called on.
No for calling on you? Okay, perfect. And then I have Jenny.
Yes, I'm here. And
okay,
yes,
Jenny,
sure, I would like to be called on.
All right, great. Okay. So if I missed you, could you please speak up now and let me know your name and whether or not you want to be called on?
Melanie.
Okay, Melanie, hi.
Hi. And yes,
okay,
you
and
can
would
call
you like
me.
To be called on? Perfect.
Yes.
Thank you, Melanie. All right, anybody else?
Hi,
yes.
My name
hi.
Is Megan.
Oops.
Megan, you're fine. Okay. Megan?
Yes, I would not like to be called on.
Okay, thank you, Megan. All right, I heard another voice in there.
Yes.
Denise.
And I don't mind being called on.
Okay, Sadie, is that what you said?
Katie with a K.
Oh, Katie. Okay, and Katie, you would not like to be called on? Okay.
I would not mind being called on.
Oh, you don't mind. Okay. And then I heard a gentleman's voice.
Yes, Seth.
All right, Seth, and would you like to be called on?
No, thank you.
No, thanks. Okay. So is that everybody?
Cindy?
Catherine? Okay, so we've got Cindy.
I don't want to be called on.
Oh. No. Okay, perfect. And then I heard a couple other voices there.
Catherine?
Okay, so Catherine, I heard.
And no, I don't want to be called on.
No. Okay. And then who was the other voice I heard?
Kathleen.
Okay, and do you want to be called on?
No, please.
Okay. All right, so is that everybody? All right, perfect. So really quickly before we get started, I just want to go over a quick little few things for the group session, especially if you're new to group sessions with me. So first and foremost, I'm not hearing a ton of background noise. So it would be really helpful to keep that going so everybody can hear, you know, what we're discussing, to make sure you have your call on mute, obviously, unless you're going to be called on or give an answer to something. Also, I want to remind you, if you have questions during the group about anything we're going over or anything we discussed, I encourage you to write the question down. And then at the end of the session, I'm going to give a few minutes so you can ask those questions. instead of asking it at the time when we're kind of having a discussion about something, it can just get a little too chaotic. So, again, I'll give you a few minutes at the end of the hour to feel free to ask any questions or things that you're unsure of that are discussed. So everybody received a copy of the Module 5 outline. And kind of what we're going to go over today is three different sections. We're going to start it off with a quick cover of the different neurodegenerative diseases that are commonly found on the exam and ways questions are asked about those diseases. Section 2 is going to be a very, very quick tutorial on a basic question dissection technique. So now you have the knowledge of the neurodegenerative disease. How do I, as a tutor, kind of teach how to break questions down and find out important information and what the question is asking? And then Section 3 is going to be actually going over some practice questions on the exam, or practice questions not on the exam, but set up like the exam questions. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and get started on Section 1. So did everybody receive the neurodegenerative disease Google form?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so go ahead and open that up. So on this form, you can see that on the left-hand side, there is a list of symptoms, and across the top, there is different neurodegenerative diseases that can match up with that symptom. So what I'm going to do is, whoever identified that, yes, they would like to be called on, I'm going to actually ask you to read the symptom and then tell me what you think, which neurological disease you think matches with that symptom.
I had a quick question. Is that
sure?
Is the Google Doc under Section 3, and it's like you just copy and paste it, or did you send that out separately?
This is actually a Google form that is a neurodegenerative disease form, and you can send that via chat message if you would like on the ClassEOT website if you weren't able to get that.
Okay. I didn't get it.
I didn't get it either. Is this the Module 5 group call outline, or is this a separate form?
Yes. Yep, this is the Module 5 group outline.
Okay, have that.
So I have that open right now, and there's the three different sections, and you should have gotten two Google Forms along with that.
I only got one form.
Yeah.
I'm only got one form. I'm struggling to hear the tutor. It's very quiet.
Okay. Is that a little bit better?
Marginally.
Okay, sorry. Sometimes the chat call can be a little scratchy. Okay, so let's just start off with Guillain-Barré syndrome. So, Kristen, what can you tell me about Guillain-Barré syndrome? Just give me, like, one fact.
So I only have the outline as well. I didn't receive any of the other documents with it. But with Guillain-Barré, usually you're seeing a very quick onset. And
mm-hmm.
then
mm-hmm.
It's also, it can be completely cured as well.
Yeah. So with Guillain-Barré syndrome, you're exactly right. It's a rapid onset of symptoms. So there's a big difference between Guillain-Barré syndrome and those other neurological diseases that are listed. So the big difference is Guillain-Barré syndrome almost presents more autoimmune. So you have those rapid onset of symptoms because of neurons mutating at a fast pace. So oftentimes people will start with symptoms. They'll get symptoms distal to proximal. So they'll get numbness and tingling in their hands and feet. And usually by about a week after that numbness and tingling in the hands and feet, they can often be paralyzed from the weight, from the neck down, and total dependence and requiring, you know, mechanical lifts to get in and out of bed and be on a ventilator and have a feeding tube. However, again, another big difference with Guillain-Barré compared to the other neurodegenerative diseases is it is not progressive, meaning most people make a full recovery. Okay, Parkinson's disease. So, Jenny, why don't you go ahead and give me one kind of important fact about Parkinson's disease?
Okay, I don't have the form, but based off of what I know, it's like rigidity, just like issues with mobility, tremor, resting tremors, action tremors. Sorry, I said like multiple things.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That's great. So Parkinson's disease, the first thing that usually comes to mind are those rigidity and tremors. The tremors are probably the most common symptom associated with Parkinson's, and it's the thing that interferes with people's independence the most, tremors in your hand. So Parkinson's disease is associated with a lack of dopamine in the body. So neurons die, dopamine is not created in the body, you get the rigidity and tremors. With Parkinson's disease, there's five stages. You don't start to notice, or the rigidity and tremors don't start to have an impact on someone's independence with ADLs until mid to late stages of the disease. So in the beginning stages, you might get some fasciculations and some very, very small, like intention-type tremors. They're usually not impacting someone's independence at that point. Parkinson's disease can take a little while to get diagnosed because of that. There is one important treatment program associated with Parkinson's disease that does show up on the exam, and that is the LSVT Big and Loud program. So the LSVT Big and Loud program is the only modality with any of these neurodegenerative diseases that can slow the progression of the disease and even make symptoms better.
Can you repeat the name of the program, please?
Sure. It's the LSVT Big and Loud program.
I'm sorry. I still can't hear you. It's the what program?
The Big and Loud program.
Big and Loud program.
Yes. Okay, perfect. So next on our list is multiple sclerosis. So, Melanie, why don't you go ahead and give me a few interesting or important facts about multiple sclerosis?
Okay, hold on 1 second. So it's an autoimmune disease, which the body's immune system attacks the myelin sheath surrounding the neurons of the brain and the spinal cord, which causes demyelination and a subsequent slowing or stopping of nerve transmission.
Perfect.
And then
okay,
there's different stages.
Could everybody just make sure that their calls are on mute, please? It just makes it very hard for everyone to hear. Okay, yes, exactly. So multiple sclerosis is autoimmune. Your body attacks itself, and we have that demyelinization of the myelin sheath. So the myelin sheath makes neurons travel quicker out to get the impulse out to tell a muscle to move. We demyelinate that nice fatty tissue, and they don't have that nice smooth surface to travel across. That's where we get the fatigue and the weakness that are associated with MS. So there's two forms of MS that we most commonly see in exam questions. The first form is relapsing and remitting, and the second is primary progressive. So relapsing remitting MS is the most common form of MS. That's where you go through periods of exacerbations and then followed by remissions. People can go through relapsing and remitting MS for years and not really know what's going on. I will say most of the time in practice, people have identified to me the way they found out they actually had MS was because of their decrease in vision. So remember, the optic nerve controls our vision. The optic nerve is surrounded in myelin. That starts to demyelinate, and you lose vision rapidly. So each year you go and you have a vision test, your vision decreases, decreases, decreases. That sometimes will prompt, oh, hey, maybe we should get an MRI to see what's going on. And we see that there's lesions on the optic nerve, which are actually demyelination. So relapsing remitting MS in most cases turns into primary progressive MS. Primary progressive MS is just periods of exacerbation, with no remission. So that is at the point where people lose function very quickly. So that's the point where people are needing a wheelchair for mobility, they're needing handicap accessible bathroom, and they're needing assistance with ADLs.
What about the secondary progressive and then the progressive relapsing.
Yep, so those are two other forms of MS, and you can certainly feel free to kind of jot those down, and then you and I can talk about those at the end of the session in the last few minutes. I'd be happy to.
Okay. Okay.
Those are very uncommon forms of MS and not generally mentioned on the exam or in exam question. Okay, so
okay,
the next one on
you.
Our list is Huntington's. Yeah, no problem. Huntington's disease. Jenny, why don't you go ahead and give us a couple of important facts about Huntington's disease?
Sure. So Huntington's disease, it's where you have the choriform-like movement. I'm trying to think.
That's the main thing that comes to my mind.
Yeah,
we get those choriform or those athetoid movement patterns. So Huntington's disease starts in the basal ganglia of the brain. So just like athetoid cerebral palsy, which also starts in the basal ganglia, our basal ganglia is kind of our motor center. So it kind of controls all of our sequential motor memory movements. So those memory movements you have of how you bring your arm up to brush your hair, or how you bring your hand up to brush your teeth, it just imagine injecting a disease into that part of your brain, and you can see where those choriform athetoid movements come from as a result. I always tell people, think of Huntington's disease as a combination of Parkinson's and dementia. Huntington's disease has five stages, like Parkinson's. The beginning stages of Huntington's often present with mood and cognitive changes only. We generally don't see those athetoid or choriform movements until mid to later stages. Huntington's disease is fairly easy to diagnose because it is genetic. So if you have it, you are 50% likely to pass it on to your offspring. So again, if you start showing those personality and cognitive changes, and one of your parents has Huntington's disease, that's a very strong indicator that you too may have Huntington's disease. Okay, next one on our list, Meniere's disease. So out of the people who identified that they would like to, you know, give information, who feels comfortable giving information about Meniere's disease?
I can.
Okay, go ahead.
So it is an inner ear disorder that causes episodes of vertigo, so like spinning.
Yeah. So Meniere's disease is one of those funky diseases that most people, upon looking at it, are like, what, you know, what does that mean? I have no clue. That's something I haven't seen before. So for those of you who have taken the test before, you know that there are going to be things that show up on the exam that you have not seen before or you might not know. So this is one of those things, if it shows up on the exam, you are definitely going to know that's an inner ear, a disease of the inner ear, which causes symptoms of vertigo. We do see it in practice. So from an occupational therapy standpoint, people, the symptoms of the disease are treated with medication. However, how is an occupational therapist going to help somebody with Meniere's disease? So we help them by giving them compensatory strategies, especially in their environment, because they are a risk for falls because of the vertigo. So we are going to do things like make sure that their home is free of clutter, make sure they have open walkways, make sure there are grab bars in areas where more falls occur, aka the bathroom. Make sure they have a shower chair in their bathroom so they're decreasing the risk of falls in the shower. Okay, very good. All right, next on our list is ALS. So, Katie, would you like to give us a few important facts about ALS?
Sure. So ALS has, I think, six stages, and the first three, you can, or maybe five, and the first three, you're walking, and then by the fourth, you're starting to lose your ambulation and your independence in ADLs. It's a progressive disease and also autoimmune.
Yeah, that's great. So it is a progressive neurological disease. You do not get better. There are six stages. And just like you said, stage four, five, and six is where people are wheelchair and bedbound at that point and also losing their ability to communicate functionally. So people with ALS do not lose their cognitive ability. Their cognition remains intact until the end. So an appropriate way to communicate after they've lost the ability of speech is going to be a big priority for treating folks with ALS. Again, like Guillain-Barré, ALS symptoms occur, distal to proximal, and it is the only other neurodegenerative disease on our list besides Guillain-Barré where you do have paralysis as a result. All right, the last is dementia. So I'm going to go back to the beginning of my list to Kristen, and I'm going to ask you to give us a couple of facts about dementia.
Okay. So with dementia, it is especially at the beginning, you're going to start seeing cognitive deficiencies, and at the beginning, the first stage, and the first thing you usually see people having difficulty with are IADLs, out especially in the community. And as the disease progresses, you'll continue to see those memory deficits, and usually, you know, again, in the home, you're going to try to simplify things as the disease continues to progress, and eventually they will lose their ability to complete ADLs on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, very good. With dementia, another important thing to mention is most of the time when the stages of dementia are mentioned on the exam, they're going to be referring to those 7 Riseberg stages of dementia. So, with the Riseberg stages of dementia, we don't see impairment or even a diagnosis until stage 3. So that's another one of those diseases where symptoms don't show until midway through the progression. That is very important in relationship to questions on the exam, because oftentimes those intervention-seeking questions that you read are going to specify mid-stages of the disease, beginning stages of the disease, or late stages of the disease. And that has a really big impact on your answer. All right, so now that we're done kind of going over the different diseases, let's go ahead to section 2 of our outline, and that is going to be a very, very quick overview of dissecting multiple choice questions apart. So I mentioned intervention-seeking questions on the test. There are 3 different types of questions on the MBCOT-OTR exam. The first type of question is an intervention-seeking question. Those are mainly domain 3. Most people who don't get a 454 on the exam end up with lower points on domain 3, or it'll say like 2 standard deviations below the norm. And oftentimes people are asking, what does that mean? That means that those intervention-based questions were very, very difficult for you. And the reason why is because they're often multi-layered. So they'll have a certain disease that you have to be very familiar with, and then they'll have an OT intervention they're seeking. You have to know both things to kind of put together the pieces of that puzzle and come up with the right answer. There also oftentimes is more than one right answer to the question, which, too, makes it very, very difficult to pick the best choice. So, again, type 1 are going to be those intervention-seeking questions. Type 2 question on the exam is going to be grading-seeking questions. So these fall under the intervention category in the sense that you are given an activity, task, or exercise your client successfully completed, and they want to know what you should do next. So we know with those types of questions, we need to grade the activity to the next level of difficulty for our client. So there is a little bit of a formula you can kind of insinuate to help solve the problem and get the best answer. Type 3 questions are going to be information-seeking or what-would-you-do questions. These are going to be those ethical, safety, OTR versus OTA questions, safety questions in the sense of, you know, your patient fell, what should you do first? Those are going to be all of those types of questions. They're not necessarily applying your knowledge as much as they are just knowledge seeking, and the fact that they want to know just if you know specifically what something means. These are a much lower percentage of the questions on the exam. However, they tend to be very difficult, because if they're asking you for knowledge that you're unaware of, it can be very hard to feel confident with what the answer is. So again, we're going to go through very quickly how to break these questions down, what to look for, and how best to kind of solve that problem. Okay, so when you get an information-seeking question or an intervention-seeking question or a grading question or what would you do, the first thing to always ask yourself to kind of center yourself and focus is going to be, where am I at in the OT process? That is something that is very, very important to identify to help find your answer. If you're evaluating your client, it can change what you would do with them because you are evaluating versus intervention versus discharge planning. Also, oftentimes in those information-seeking questions or intervention-seeking questions, they will say, what is your recommendation? What should you do next? So when they're asking for a recommendation, that means they are asking for your input on something. So as the therapist, what is your input? When they're asking for an intervention, that means you have to therapeutically use yourself in the situation. How best are you going to physically insert yourself with your client? When they ask things like, what should you do next? What should you do immediately? Sometimes that clues us in that, hey, all three answers I'm given might all ring true. I need to pick the one that chronologically comes first. Is that making sense for everybody?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. All right, for grading questions, we're given your client, there's a question that circulates around often. You're working with somebody with Down syndrome. They successfully made a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. What are you going to do for the next OT session? And a lot of people try to think back to the little cooking chart, the cooking hierarchy chart, and you try to kind of jog your memory. Okay, we did a simple cold meal. What comes next? Well, you can use an even simpler way, and you can say, I have to choose an activity that is the same with one degree of difficulty added to it. So that's kind of like the equation to solve that problem. So let's say your answer choices are cook a stir-fry meal, make a microwave dinner, or cook a grilled cheese sandwich. So an activity that is the same with a degree of difficulty is going to be the grilled cheese sandwich. So the way we make a grilled cheese is similar to the steps of making a PB&J. The degree of difficulty we have added to that activity is going to be using the stove, the heat component. We know when somebody's working on cooking skills, teaching them how to safely use a stove in an oven is a very important piece of that. So we can make not only cold meals, but we can make hot meals as well. Okay, so when answering those what would you do or information seeking questions, we're always looking for collecting objective data and documenting our results. So in most situations, so let's say we're given the question where it says, you know, your client fell during your OT session, what should you do first? And never ever is the choice going to be like, oh, go get a nurse to come help you make sure your client isn't injured. That rarely is ever the choice. Usually the choices are going to be something like file the policy and procedure and file an incident report. Tell your OT supervisor of what happened. Or, you know, let the nurse know on the unit what happened. So when we are collecting objective information and documenting our results, as that is part of the OT process, remember, if we didn't document it, it didn't happen. So we know our best answer is going to be, oh, hey, following the company's policy and procedure on falls, and then filling out the incident report is me documenting what happened. So I have that piece of documentation. That's what happened. I bring that to my OT supervisor. I bring that to the nurse on the unit. And then we can go from there. Okay. Does anybody have any questions before we move on to the next section?
No.
Okay, perfect. So the next section, go ahead and open up the practice questions. Or wait, no, the practice questions are, okay, they're inserted right into the document. Perfect. Okay. So I'm going to call on Jenny. What I would like you to do, Jenny, is I would like you to read the question. We're not going to look at the answers yet, and I'm actually going to ask you questions about the question so we can really get a good idea of how to effectively break the question down and come to the right answer. So okay. Whenever you are ready, go ahead and read that first one.
Okay. A client in the beginning stages of Huntington's disease is displaying difficulty with their morning ADL routine. Which of the following treatment options would be best for the OT to implement first?
Okay. So this is a very, very basic intervention seeking type 1 question. So they want to know, what should you do first? So my first question to you is, where are you at in the OT process? Even though it seems pretty obvious, just go ahead and reiterate to me. Where are you at in the OT process with this client?
Treatment?
Intervention?
Yeah, we're intervening, we're treating them. Very good. Mm-hmm. What is the client's disease or diagnosis?
Huntington's
disease. And what does it specify? Where are we at in the disease process?
Beginning stages.
So what did we talk about earlier in the session about the beginning stages of Huntington's disease?
It affects cognition and mood before progressing into the...
Exactly. So mood and cognition are often the very first signs, and this patient is in the beginning stages. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to skip over to Melanie, and I'm going to have Melanie go ahead and get rid of 2 wrong answers and tell me why.
Decluttering the client's bathroom to allow for easier access using assistive devices and recommending a shower bench for the shower chair. And then also recommending a caregiver be hired to provide ADL assistance to the client. Anticipation of the disease progression. For that one, it's because you're in the earlier stages of Huntington's disease, so I don't think they would require a caregiver.
Very good. We're never going to give more help than what our client needs. Very good. Okay.
Right.
And what about decluttering the bathroom?
Well, because we're also in the earlier stages, like, you're going to want to focus on the mood and the cognition disorder.
So decluttering the bathroom would be appropriate if the question said mid-stages of Huntington's disease. Then we would know that the athetoid and the choreiform movements would be affecting their ADL status. But that's not the case.
Right.
So between the two that are left, which one do you think is the better intervention and why?
Providing the client with a poster consisting of pictures of the order of the client's sink side grooming routine start to finish. And that'll help them with their cognition disorder and remembering, like, the steps of getting ready in the morning.
Yes, exactly. So we were able to identify what happens in the beginning stages of the disease, and that had a huge impact on our answer. So the safest answer, the most occupation-based answer, sometimes those little clues don't always work in these intervention questions. We really have to have a good grasp of what the disease is and what exactly the question is looking for in our treatment. All right, very, very good. So I am going to call on Katie next to read the next question, please.
An OTR is providing education to the family of a client in the end stages of ALS. Which statement best describes the appropriate recommendation?
Okay, so. What type of question is this?
Like a consultation?
It's a type 1 intervention question, but it's asking for what? Your
recommendation?
Yes, it's asking for your recommendation, your input. So we know, okay, this isn't me necessarily, like, physically working with the client. This is me, like, giving the family, the caregivers, information, like, important information, important to occupational therapy and what we do. So what is the client's diagnosis?
ALS.
ALS. And what does it specify where we're at in the disease progression?
End stages.
Cool. So what did we say about the end stages of ALS?
They're going to pretty much be dependent with the functional mobility and most ADLs. They might not have their speech. They might have difficulty with swallowing.
So that's where the disease progression is really coming into play, total dependence, wheelchair, bedbound. All right, so let's go ahead back to Kristen and go ahead and eliminate two wrong answers for me and tell me why.
So let's eliminate setting up a formal home exercise program. Given that the client is at end stages, physically they're not really doing much now, and so that's not going to be feasible for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
And then the next one, encouraging the client to complete their ADL self-feeding and home exercise program as independently as possible. We're at the stage where the family really is going to be assisting, you're going to be seeing that caregiver assistance. They're not able to complete their ADLs at this point.
Yeah, very good. Those two really don't have anything to do with this point in the disease progression as things that are going to be important to this person's care. So out of the two left over, which one is the better recommendation and why?
I would say the last one.
Okay.
Knowing, I feel like at this point you would have already seen a home health evaluation for an SLP. But the main reason why I'm leaning towards the last one, just knowing that there are going to be wheelchair and bed bound. So just the idea, you know, for pressure relief and just having a schedule so that we are giving them the appropriate movement to avoid any sores or ulcers.
Yeah, so recommending the client seek out a formal SLP home health eval, that is very luring as an answer because we know in the end stages of ALS, people lose the ability to communicate. And we know setting up an appropriate and effective communication source/device for them is super important to their care. However, that recommendation has you recommending the family seek out a formal SLP. That isn't necessarily something that you as the OT are really giving them that is going to be therapeutic and that is going to be something you as a skilled practitioner provide. So those are the answers we're choosing. We're choosing answers that a skilled practitioner provides. So again, that making sure the pressure relief so we can avoid ulcers and sores and skin breakdown, as that is a huge risk at this point in the disease progression. All right, very good. So let's go ahead and call on Jenny. Go ahead and read the next question, please.
Okay, ACOTA is working with the client that the diagnosis of primary progressive multiple sclerosis. On sing-side grooming tasks, the client displays fatigue, decreased upper extremity strength, and intention tremors. Which adaptive strategy would be best when completing teeth hygiene?
Okay. So, again, what type of question is this?
I would say intervention because it's asking for adaptive strategy.
Yeah, you answered my next question. So this is an intervention seeking question. And then we're looking for an adaptive strategy. So what is the difference between an adaptive strategy versus adaptive equipment?
I guess something with that equipment. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So adaptive equipment is a physical tool we give clients to help them be more independent with a task. So a sack aid, a long-handled reacher, a shoehorn, all of those, a U-cup, those are pieces of adaptive equipment. It's something physical that we give to increase independence. Adaptive strategies are using your body or the environment to compensate for a lack of whatever to complete an activity. So somebody who is T6 spinal cord injury, to do lower body dressing in bed, they will prop themselves up against the headboard or in the corner to compensate for their lack of trunk control. That is an adaptive strategy. Using dressing loops to help assist with pulling on pants for lower body dressing, those dressing loops are adaptive equipment. Does everybody understand?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. All right, Melanie, go ahead and get rid of two wrong answers for me and tell me why.
Okay. I would get rid of the universal cusp for which a toothbrush fits and handled flosser, and also a weighted electric toothbrush and a water pick, because those are both adaptive equipment.
Yeah, that's great. So see how easy you just made your job. You got rid of two pieces of adaptive equipment because we know that's not what we're looking for. Okay, so now we're left with two answers. One has us trapping the elbow on the sink. The other has us applying pressure through our hands. So this goes back to the problems we're addressing in the question. So what are the problems this patient has as a result of their MS?
Fatigue, decreased upper extremity strength, and intention tremors.
Okay, so they've got a lot going on. Those are all very common symptoms of MS. Whenever you're given multiple problems in a question, an intervention question, I always say you have to prioritize those problems. The first priority is always a problem that causes your client pain. That comes first. You treat that first. If there isn't a problem on the list that causes pain, we think which problem will impede their independence with this activity the most. So between fatigue, decreased upper extremity strength, and an intention tremor, which one will impede this client's independence with teeth hygiene the most?
The intention tremor?
Yes, the intention tremor. So that's a problem we have to address first. So between having them stabilize their hands in the sink versus having them seated, which one of those strategies helps an intention tremor?
Have the client stabilize their hands on the sink, applying pressure, so then the intention tremor decrease.
Exactly. So if your hand is shaking, you apply pressure, you bear down on it, your hand stops shaking. So you go to do the next step in the activity, your hand starts shaking again, you put it down and apply more pressure. That is a very effective adaptive strategy for that purpose. All right, very, very good. Next question, Katie, go ahead and read that for me, please.
A retired client in the mid-stages of dementia would display the most difficulty with which of the following tasks? Should I read them?
Okay. No, go ahead and tell me where are you at in the, or what type of question is this?
An intervention question? Or is it asked?
It's sort of an intervention, but it's also kind of like just information seeking. These are one of those non-applied questions. This is just looking for, like, do you know what dementia is?
Okay.
So where are we at in the stage of our dementia?
Mid-stages.
Okay, so what's commonly going on in the mid-stages that we discussed?
So they're starting to, forget somewhat less commonly done ADLs. They're starting to have difficulty with not so much orientation, but maybe just completing tasks without forgetting steps.
They're just getting the steps. Really starting with difficulty with more short-term memory activities and more higher-level IADL at that point. Okay, so Kristen, let's go ahead and get rid of two wrong answers and tell me why.
So the first one I would get rid of is giving a detailed description of their childhood home and favorite holidays. That's in their long-term memory. So that shouldn't be impacted quite yet.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I would get rid of the first one as well, filling out a leisure history checklist, listing past interests and hobbies.
Okay, very good.
I think because it's a checklist, it's very short and quick to the point, and it's past interest. So, again, it's going back to that long-term memory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. All right. So let's go ahead, Jenny, and what are we left with?
So I was going to go with recounting their daily routine for the past week because it's more associated with the short-term memory.
Yeah. So that's the only option that really is more of a short-term memory option. All the other three are long-term memories. So that's kind of another method you can use when eliminating answers to try to find the best one. If two answers seem very similar in the information they're providing you, so aka they're all long-term memory, we often know that those aren't, neither one of them are correct. And that's a great way to get rid of wrong answers and get left with your choice. So again, with people in the stages of dementia, they will not have trouble telling you what their favorite meal as a child was, but they will have trouble remembering what they had for dinner last night. All right, so Melanie, let's go ahead and read the last one, please.
Excuse me, Jessica.
Yep.
So what? Which one is the answer? The last one, recounting their daily routine.
Yes.
But you just said that they will have a problem recalling what they did yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But then this one here is saying that you know their daily routine for the past week.
Yes, that's a short-term memory because it was just in the past week. All the other answers are long-term memories.
Okay.
Very good. All right, Melanie, let's go ahead. Take it away.
All right. Which frame of reference best fits the following scenario? An OTR is working with a client in the mid-stages of Parkinson's disease. They display difficulty with fine motor tasks, ADL and IADLs, specifically, their resting hand tremors inhibit their ability to initiate self-feeding, grooming, and teeth hygiene. The OTR recommends the client use weighted utensils for self-feeding and a weighted electric toothbrush for hygiene. Prior to completing sink-side grooming tasks, the patient completes a series of repetitive large movement upper extremity exercises as part of the formal home exercise program.
Phew, these ones are always hard. Frame of reference questions. So then it kind of opens up a little bit of a discussion about the frame of references. Those are a topic that come up on the exam over and over and over again. And again, for those of you who have taken the test before, you can probably remember at least a few questions involving frame of references. So again, that's a topic that is important to feel comfortable with going into the exam. So what do we have going on? What do we know? What has been presented to us in this question?
The patient is mid-stage of Parkinson's disease.
Okay, mid-stages of Parkinson's. What are we doing for them?
We've provided weighted utensils for self-feeding and a weighted electric toothbrush for hygiene.
Mm-hmm. And what else? What else are we doing for them?
Upper extremity exercises.
Yeah, so we've provided some adaptive equipment. We've also provided them with some exercises to help decrease tremors and increase upper extremity use. So we're taking a bit of a compensatory and a rehabilitative approach. So we're doing both. Which frame of reference do you feel comfortable getting rid of right off the bat? Go ahead and answer that for me, Katie.
OA, occupational adaptation.
Okay, what makes you comfortable to get rid of that one?
Because we're using the repetitive large movement upper extremity exercises, it means that it's not solely occupational adaptation.
Yeah, occupational adaptation focuses strictly on adapting, compensating, or modifying the person, environment, or the occupation. What it does not focus on is it does not focus on remediating or rehabilitating a client's deficits. Occupational adaptation is a great frame of reference to use with clients who have permanent disabilities or, you know, permanent progressive diseases. So remediation and rehabilitation aren't huge on the list of what you're going to do best for them. So let's say somebody has a C6 spinal cord injury. You know, they're 6 months out of their acute rehab stay. You're a home health occupational therapist. You go in and you help them come up with adaptations to their new apartment. You help set up, you know, set their bathroom up, set their ADL morning routine. That is an occupational adaptation approach. All right, let's go ahead, Katie, and tell me another one you would comfortably get rid of.
So I'm going to openly say I'm not too great at frames of reference.
That's okay.
But I'm tempted to get rid of Moho because I don't feel like we're, like, nothing about the scenario screaming, like, that this is the patient's volition, like, that this is what they want to be working on.
Yeah. You're exactly right. So Moho looks at what intrinsically motivates a client, and we base our treatment off that intrinsic motivation. Evidence shows that when somebody finds meaning and purpose in what they do better at it. However, nowhere in this question is it really saying, like, this client really, really wants to be independent with brushing their teeth. It just isn't mentioning it. So it just, Moho doesn't really scream out to me as being relevant. So we got rid of occupational adaptation. We got rid of Moho. We're left with Ecology of Human Performance and POP. Those are probably two of the most confusing frame of references out of them all to put into practice. So really quickly, Ecology of Human Performance chooses an activity based upon a patient's level of ability, and it grades that activity as their skills increase. So it is a rehabilitative or a remediation frame of reference. We are focused on deficits. We do use adaptive equipment, adaptive strategies, and modifications within the Ecology of Human Performance frame of reference. I often refer to it as like the Goldilocks frame of reference because you're trying to find that just right fit. So you don't give your client an activity that is too easy, and you don't give them one that is too hard. Okay, POP in a nutshell looks at how the environment impacts the outcome of the occupation. So POP is a great frame of reference to use in a home health setting. Where does your environment impact your independence with occupations more than home health, or at home, I should say? It's also great in a work environment as well, because, again, where you work is where you're at most of the day, and that has a huge impact on your independence with your occupations as well. Okay, so after that quick little run-through of the last two answers, Kristen, what do you think is the right frame of reference for this situation and why?
Ecology of Human Performance.
Yes, Ecology of Human Performance. We've adapted their sink-side routine. We've given them equipment. We're also giving them exercises to remediate the tremors. We gave them that just-right fit for the activity, and we're also remediating their skills. That is Ecology of Human Performance. Had the question been changed and said the client was trying to access their first floor bathroom, and it was a small bathroom, and it didn't have, like, it only had a pedestal sink. It didn't have a vanity to lay out their equipment for their sink-side grooming routine, then we would say, okay, the environment is negatively impacting this client's ability to perform sink-side grooming. How might we change that? So from a POP standpoint, that's what we look at. We look at the environment. So we could do a couple of things. We could adapt the current environment to support them, or we could take them out of the environment. Maybe we could suggest, okay, you can't use this bathroom, but maybe you can use the kitchen sink. We can put a little mirror in front of it. And then they have room to lay out all their tools, and their independence is increased as a result. Okay, how is everybody feeling on neurodegenerative diseases and that very, very quick run through on how to break questions down?
I have a question on the occupational adaptation and, like, how we chose that wasn't, like, one of the answers.
Sure, go ahead.
Like, there was the weighted electrical toothbrush. And then mm-hmm. the weighted utensils. So, like, isn't that, like, adapting? But was it because
sure
of the repetitive large movement?
Yes, with occupational adaptation, we're not focused on remediating or rehabilitating a client's deficit. So we're just focused on adapting, modifying,
if they took out the repetitive large movements, then that possibly could have been the answer?
That definitely potentially could have been. Remember, occupational adaptation is a better frame of reference to use where our client's skills won't necessarily get better because of the nature of their diagnosis.
Okay.
So, just to confuse me, So, Jessica, but with this question, you have adaptive equipment that the client is using, right?
Yeah.
So is that not like, you know, using those equipment to adapt the occupation that the client is supposed to do? That's why I was going to go with the occupational adaptation, but I got so confused.
Yes, occupational adaptation, when there's any sort of adapting happening, automatically becomes like everybody's go-to, what they want to choose. And that's why you really need to focus on, okay, what is our goal here? What are we doing with our client? Are we strictly just adapting, modifying based on their level of their disease or what they have going on? What are we doing with them is really what you need to ask yourself.
Okay,
so we've got about 3 minutes left of the session. This is the time that I normally like to open it up if, you know, a few people have already asked some questions. If anybody else had any other questions about anything pertaining to what we've talked about today, I'm more than happy at this time to answer your questions for you.
Yes, would you be able to go over briefly just like the three stages of Guillain-Barré?
Sure. So why don't you first fill me in on how you understand Guillain-Barré?
So I know that there's like an acute phase and then the remediation phase and then the plateau phase in the middle. But what I have trouble with is sometimes the length of those or sometimes the intervention that you would be completing within each stage.
Yeah, so remember, for everybody, Guillain-Barré is different, right? How it affects us. The biggest kind of factor is going to be like somebody's age when they're diagnosed with it and what they had going on prior to. So in my almost 20 years as an OT, I only ever saw two people with Guillain-Barré syndrome. So it's very, very, very uncommon. One person I saw had MS prior to and was in their 70s. So it took them a very long time to progress through the stages of Guillain-Barré and to make their recovery. And unfortunately, they were unable to make a full recovery. They still had lower extremity weakness and they had a right foot drop a year after the Guillain-Barré. The other person I treated or was able to actually see on field work was a 22-year-old with Guillain-Barré. They presented much differently than the 70-year-old with MS. They progressed quickly through the stages and made a full recovery from the Guillain-Barré because of their age and the fact that they didn't really have any other comorbidities affecting their progress. So the first phase of Guillain-Barré I know can last up to a month as your condition or your symptoms kind of worsen, and that's kind of the phase where people become completely paralyzed, requiring total care. So the plateau phase, as you were already able to identify, that's going to be where that's going to be a very, very short phase. So you actually want the plateau phase to be short. I know that if the longer the plateau phase, the more poor the prognosis. So my client that was in their 70s that had MS had a longer plateau phase than my 22-year-old. So a short phase in the plateau is considered anything under a month. Okay, and then
okay,
the last phase is going to be that recovery phase. And, you know, the recovery phase is usually a few months after onset, and obviously we know what happens in the recovery phase. We're starting to regain function. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thanks.
You're welcome. All right. Does anybody else have any other questions before we
hang
up?
What
secondary
progressive and the progressive relapsing? I know you said those are just other terms, but not as common.
Yeah. Yeah, so secondary progressive MS is very, very much less common than relapsing and remitting and primary progressive MS. So I'm not even sure if I've ever heard people tell me that they've seen that on the exam. So secondary progressive MS is much more, dramatic. So
okay.
You get more weakness, more coordination issues. You get bowel and bladder problems, more fatigue, depression, and it's more of a rapid onset. So, again, it's just like one big exacerbation.
Okay. Because it was on the, worksheet on the PASI-OT under the MS.
Yeah, for sure. No problem. I totally get it. So, and then...
Thank you.
No problem. So, anybody else have any other questions?
I had a quick question, or it might not be quick, but when I was looking at the last question for the frame of reference one, it was really confusing, only because, I don't know, it just threw me off the way the question was written, and I thought I knew all of the frame of references pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what you would suggest in terms of knowing it, thoroughly, or, would you just say, review the PASI OT content to, have a better understanding of it?
Yes, and I would also say be able to come up with an intervention idea in your head for each frame of reference. So if I was to give you an example of, I have a client who had a stroke and they have their dominant upper extremity has some hemiparesis, they want to be independent with self-seeding, tell me an intervention approach using the Ecology of Human Performance frame of reference. So I might have a really good idea of being able to do that. To feel super confident with the frame of references, putting them into practice rather than just being able to regurgitate, the definition.
Okay.
Does that help?
I think so. I have to, look more into it to make sure, I'm more confident with it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, frame of references are dense. It's a big topic area, and they can be very confusing. And when you're very burnt out from studying, sometimes going over the same thing over and over again, you don't really know it any better. It almost gets worse. So it's just coming up with a really good study plan that is effective and realistic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, so we're pretty much out of time.
The match the symptom with the disease that was in the Google Doc. Do we just do that on our own?
Yeah, you sure can do that on your own, and that's going to really let you know that you picked up all the information from the discussion.
Okay.
So if anybody has any further questions, you can feel free to email me. You have my email address. It was a great session today. Everybody had really great questions, and I really enjoyed the participation as well. I hope to hear everybody at the next group session.
Sorry, Jessica, before you go, your email, please. I don't have it.
Okay, you know what? You can actually get my email. Go ahead onto the chat, the PASI OT chat, and you can get my email from there and email any questions you have.
Okay.
All right? All right, everybody, have a great rest of your week. If you're celebrating Thanksgiving, have a great Thanksgiving. Otherwise, we will hopefully hear from each other at the next session.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
bye.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Hello, Jessica.